Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Daphne Athis is a beloved teacher of creative writing. We know her for that. We know her about her wonderful classic fiction, her novel about Chapel Hill, and her experiences growing up here, entering Ephesus. Now she has a new book, and she's written poetry and nonfiction and other novels. Now she has shared with us in a new book, Chapel Hill in Plain Sight, Notes from the Other Side of the Tracks, nonfiction about her experiences in Chapel Hill. And she's agreed to come talk to us about the book and about Betty Smith and Ab Abernathy and Junior Scales and Horace Williams and Max Steele, Paul Green, a host of other people that you and I have heard about, but we didn't really know. And Daphne Athis did. And thanks for your book, and thanks for being willing to share with us at WCHL. First of all, Daphne Athis, you're an alumnus of WCHL. You had a radio program.
Yeah, I did.
And you didn't write about it in your book, in your new book. Were you not proud of your...
No, I was. It was called Wordplay, kind of preceded Grammarama, that book which they, Marianne Ginger's teaching as a stylistic class and also as a performance art to learn grammar
and so you
in creative writing.
This was a precursor of that, is that?
It was part and parcel of the time that I was writing that, quote, textbook, unquote.
And so WCHL listeners helped you write this book that is still in use as a teaching vehicle?
I actually wrote that book. It was in a period when I really couldn't write novels because I had my mother was need to be taken care of. So for some reason, this affected me in the sense that I could definitely write. I was always writing, but it was in about words. It was about grammar. It was about language.
Well, all right. Well, we solidify the connection. Welcome back to WCHL.
Gee, thanks. They were 3-minute spots
on
football days.
Wow.
Well, grammar versus football, or grammar plus football.
Remember, bringing together the academic and
the
athletic
games and the games.
Powerhouses.
I mean, it was games and games. Really? Serious.
Well, we're proud of that connection. Listen, talk to us. First of all, your new book is great. It is not all new work, but it's all it is based on columns and things that you've written over the years, but very nicely updated. You didn't let them. It's current in the sense that you've brought current. So I declare it to be a brand new book. But it's
yes, I think you're absolutely right to think of it that way. In fact, it is, because in the process of writing it dealt with what order should they be in. What for me, I'm used to if you write a novel, you want to go, you want to say something, you want some kind of a unity of thought or of character, whatever holds it together, or of plot, but say something beyond. This is nonfiction. Each of these, quote, essays, unquote, are stories, all of them true, are examinations of the past, historical things, which are fascinating. All of them, each chapter, you read on its own. The challenge in it was to say something as an entity, although you could
read them separately, but they do hang together, and it's a challenge.
You found that they hang together.
I'm very suspicious of collections of columns because I think the challenge is that you write them and they're happily set in a time and a mood of a particular time and place. And so it's difficult.
Frankly, you're absolutely right.
But you've, I think, accomplished it. And so I don't want to debate that point. We agree on that. I hope it – and so I want to ask you another question about this new book. How am I going to do this with respect? Because I want to do this with great respect. Your autobiographical fictional novel, Entering Ephesus, told a lot about your experience as a young person being transported from New England to Chapel Hill and becoming a Chapel Hillian, but also always being from the outside in some respects. And so to some degree, you tell the story on a nonfiction basis here. But you told the story so well in Entering Ephesus. Why'd you have to tell it again?
Excellent. Because the outside world changed. That's why. Because I recognized that I could say split my life into three pieces. Or the first was the period of the war when at 15 years old I came to Chapel Hill. And that was during the war. The war was over. The GIs came back on the GI Bill. It was extremely exciting that the whole world changed overnight. But you couldn't get out of the country. You know, the people that I knew, I met Max Steele during that period because he had been a GI in Trinidad in climatology. All the people that I knew, I was of the war generation, but not the older part, the younger part.
You were a teenager during the war.
I was a teenager.
Yeah. And so you watched it and knew what was going on and then absorbed the excitement, but never called on to go serve or the,
I tried to, but you couldn't get in the wax unless you were 25 years old. That was the rule.
Well,
all of my friends, high school and college, immediately they were in the service, but they were still here. They were very young. They were freshmen, like around freshman and sophomore. Instead of being dog soldiers, they were got in the programs for special fields for climatology, for medical school, languages schools. So they went to school. They were in uniform, but they went to school. It was a totally different type of war situation from any war ever since, because the people weren't. Nobody was jingoistic, and everybody was ignorant. You know, they didn't know what Europe. People didn't know what Europe was like. It wasn't a global world then. Cool, the word cool had never come in then. It was very ignorant, and so they kind of thought, oh, well, this, being in the service, we're guys, and they weren't jingoistic. None of this kind of patriotism existed. They took pride in being
called
including
upon to do
the dog soldiers.
Yeah, that's great. I want to back up just a little bit.
Go.
Both in Entering Ephesus and in the new book, this is an extraordinary story, and so let me try to frame the question: is how did a family your parents' first generation, I think, Greek immigrants?
My father was a Greek immigrant. My mother was an entrenched and cultured Yankee whose forebears came in the 1630s.
Oh, well, so you got two branches.
Yeah, Obama.
So New England Yankee and a Greek mother and a Greek immigrant father. Totally New England, different backgrounds, but totally settled in New England. Why come to Chapel Hill? Why did they bring you all to Chapel Hill?
Because Chapel Hill was, quote, unquote, Athens of the South. It had a tradition of teaching Socratic dialogue.
But I mean, New England is full of educational institutions that whose reputations were even more even higher than Chapel Hill's. Why leave that center of higher education for the Athens of the South? Right.
Well, my mother grew up in Cambridge, and my father released her from all of this New England ladydom where even being, she didn't think she should go to Radcliffe. Of course, she would never have gone to Harvard because it didn't admit women.
Right.
Because they were blue stockings, they wore spectacles and were ugly. So she was very, you know, well brought up and went to the New England Conservatory, learned three languages, was very smart, and came from not Boston Brahmins, but her aunts married textile mill owners in Lowell and Lawrence. Depression, 1929, wham, all of a sudden.
Everybody got wiped out.
Well, most of the more gilded people didn't lose all their money, but we did. Like everything, zero, zero. So it was like going from way high to way low. Of course, I was at the age of 6 years old. I heard something about the Central Trust Company when my mother was cutting some cloth to make a dress or something. The scissors were going yog, yog, yog. It's in the book. And, of course, but I didn't know what money was. Kids don't know aggregate money. Money was 25 cents that we took to school and deposited in our bank accounts, you know, as children. Being in the primary school, and so all of it went, and then that was 1929. But you see, it was just radical in our case. Maybe I don't know why. Maybe because my father, who was a stockbroker and had gone to Harvard Law School, he did not do the usual immigrant thing. He didn't start a restaurant.
Right.
Why?
Why come to Chapel Hill?
First of all, it was a public university, Harvard University.
Now, did he have in mind that this would be a way that his children could get an education on modest?
It was very vague, but somehow, if we came to this spot, we would get into the university. And we did get into the university, even as girls, when nobody got in.
So that part of his plan worked out, but now I'm still having trouble. Your dad, he's an immigrant. He's stepped out and gotten a good education and entered the professional class, comes to Chapel Hill, and has to scrape by.
Right. Well, it's a very, you know, you can either think of things in social and economic way, but then you can also think of them in a social way as family. And then you also have the individual people that come to America from somewhere else. I mean, like Soros, for instance. Well, he came, but he had already made money, and he came from a rather well-heeled family. I'm thinking Romania, or I think. Mm-hmm. But the immigrants that my father came were before the First World War. Everybody came through Liverpool, and I never really realized that until way, way later. And he did not give us details. We did not know he had a brother, for instance, not until I went to Greece way late in life to meet him there. And I met him and lived in a field of grapefruit.
We've got to take a break.
Yeah,
I hate to interrupt you, but I want to, when we come back, I want you to talk about where you guys lived when you did move to Chapel Hill. And it wasn't in any mansion. We're visiting with Daphne Affis about her new book, Chapel Hill in Plain Sight. She and I'll be right back. Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Daphne Affis about her newest book, Chapel Hill in Plain Sight, Notes from the Other Side of the Tracks. And there's just too much to talk about. The book is – we're never going to get to all of the great things that you talk about in this book, Daphne Affis. But one of the startling things both about – entering Ephesus and about now the real story about where your family lived when they first came to Chapel Hill. Tell us about those places and help us see where they are in today's geography.
Okay. The first house we came to was in Patterson Place, which was a wonderful place to live.
Near where? Where is Patterson? For those who
Patterson Place goes off of Ransom Street, which goes between Cameron Avenue, Macaulay Street, Van Street.
Near Westwood, sort of.
A little west.
A little west of
Yeah, about two blocks west of the campus.
Okay, so you start out there.
We started out
there. Neighborhood.
Nice neighborhood.
And your dad had arranged this?
He had arranged it. He had come a year before we did, Mother and the Three Girls. He came with my brother. And he paid delinquent taxes on a farm on the Raleigh Road, raised tomatoes, existed. Then he rented this house on Patterson Place, which was nice, very nice. It still stands. It's across from a place that Miss Crook lived in, which is on Ransom Street. And Charlotte and Raymond Adams lived across Ransom Street on Patterson Place.
When your mother and your sisters drove down from your home in New England and piled out of the car, and
yeah.
Must have been scared to death.
Not at all. It was like she read, you know, she evoked Robinson, Swiss Family Robinson.
Oh, really? The child was on an adventure.
My mother was fantastic, very funny. Both of my parents had all of this juice to them, and they were wits, but totally different, totally different. But she was an adventurer. That's what she wanted to get. That's what appealed to her about my father, coming from a completely different. She was smitten, see. She was an upper class. But he was a maverick.
Well, now why did you leave Patterson Place, and then where did you go?
Because it probably cost too much rent.
This was
right.
About 1930, late 1930s.
Well, it was in the late 30s. It was like 39. It was 38, the end of 38 that we came. We entered school in October late. My older sister and I failed the first geometry test and were saved by the teacher, Mr. Munch, because he tutored us for 2 weeks, and they were on cuts.
So you walk into school where – to go into school where did you go to school?
We walked into high school, which is where the pharmacy school is now on the
– Right.
Where, across from which is the medical
– All right. Now, after school. You left Patterson Place
– Yeah.
This is what's most interesting to me, and you say with pride we lived in the shack.
Right.
Where was the shack?
The shack was on Merritt Mill Road, and if you walk west on Cameron Avenue, it goes in a T to Merritt Mill Road. You turn left, and it was a little past that T. At that time, it was a dirt road.
And it was the country. It was the edge of the country. I guess.
It was the edge of the town.
Right near the border of Carrboro, right where the bike path starts now.
Exactly. The bike path follows exactly the railroad tracks, and that was the first bike path in Chapel Hill, and an excellent one in that it got you off the road. It wasn't just a white line where you had to
dodge. I don't
want
to talk about it, but you got a beautiful essay about the bike path. But I want to stay with the shack.
Okay.
Here are these girls who've grown up in New England. You got a mama who's high-class Cambridge Bostonian, and a daddy who's an immigrant but I've got a professional background. And he's moving you all into really – I mean, it was the shack, wasn't it? I mean,
Yes. What it was an old house that dated back before the Civil War, and it had been lived in by whites. And there was a – anyway, it had a lot of trees around it. And it had land. It had a barn. It had a well that was poisoned because we were told puppies or a whole litter of puppies had been thrown in it or something. I don't know whether that's true or not. It had an outside kitchen because they used to have outside kitchens in those days to cook meals. And it had a shed. So it had all that stuff. It had a field that you looked and saw nothing except in the winter you could sort of hear a kind of a Tim Top area where black people lived, and you could hear singing and things like that, which was very exotic. And people, but nobody, no whites lived there. Why? Because it cost $18 a month.
Oh, well.
Which was cheap, I guess.
Yeah.
Cheaper than we were paying in Patterson Place.
Well, let's take a quick break.
Okay.
And then we'll come back and talk about some of the people that you met as you were growing up in Chapel Hill. We're visiting with Daphne Athis about her new book, Chapel Hill in Plain Sight. She and I'll be right back.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill, University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking.
Thank you.
This is D.G. Martin.
Fun.
Oh, Daphne Athis, you make it fun, and this is great.
D.G. Martin.
Your wonderful book, Chapel Hill in Plain Sight, should be required reading for any of us who are sort of new Chapel Hill people, because we can't cover all the things that you cover and all the people that you cover in your book, but I'd love for you to talk about some of them. And one of the puzzling people for me in Chapel Hill is this Betty Smith character. And the idea that she wrote a book about Brooklyn while she was living in Chapel Hill kind of is an extraordinary story for me. And so I've never really gotten my arms around that story until I read about your encounters and your friendship with Betty Smith and her daughter. So will you tell us a little bit of that story?
Right. She had two daughters, Mary and Nancy. And Nancy was a year older. Mary was a year younger. But I got put in the class with Mary, and then I skipped a class. I think Nancy did, too, and we graduated together.
You wound
together.
Up in the same class. Now, why was she here?
She was here because she was a playwright, and she was on the Franklin Roosevelt program of the WPR, but it was a playwriting. You know, he had these programs for artists. If you go in any post office in the country, you see the paintings up. They were all done on the WPA federal program for writers and artists.
So she came here to be a playwright.
She came here because Paul Green was here, and because they had that program, she was hired as in the Playmakers in some capacity.
To write original plays.
She wrote original plays.
And they were, we love the current Playmakers, but in the old days, they, as you point out in your book, remind us in the book, they were writing plays and then putting them on. I mean, it was
not, that was a terrific thing, because every Friday night they had original plays in the old Playmakers Theater right on the campus. And she was the judge half the time. But she didn't teach, but she and her collaborator, Bob Finch, had written many plays, and they had published many plays, and playwriting was the type of writing that you wrote then, not novels, not
and
short
Chapel Hill
stories.
Was a hotbed of
it was indeed
drama. If you'd go back a little bit, that Thomas Wolfe also wanted to be a playwright, couldn't make it successfully, so he had to write a novel, and it worked, and sort of is the story sort of the same with Betty Smith, that her plays were fine, but they weren't going to make her a lot of money. And
true, that's true. I think it was more or less because she was so possessed with her own story, which was fantastic, because Tree Grows in Brooklyn shows a way of life which was extinct to me when I was 15 years old. She grew up in really poor in Brooklyn from German immigrants. She had a brother and a sister, and that she was made to leave to work at age 14. So she was good in school. She spent her days in the library. But her brother was the one that should have been educated. So he was, and she worked. And then she married very early and went to the University of Michigan, where her husband was studying law. I mean, they were very young. She had kids. She stood outside classrooms to hear professors. She never had a college education. She was in love with learning. She met Robert Frost when she was working at a skating rink, and he was so cheap, he wanted to get in for nothing. And, I mean, that's how she learned. So she had this ever-flowing desire to, but she was always working, too. I mean, she got up at 5 just because she was in love with plays, with theater, with writing. But she wasn't an intellectual. She didn't read. She often said, read better than you write. But she was very aware of the market and what it was. But she was possessed with this burning ambition and ambition and love of reading and writing.
One of the great things that you bring to the table in your experience and in the book for folks who are interested in Betty Smith is that you knew her well before she was famous. You got to see her when she was a nobody, also living in a house that was too crowded and cheap and having to deal, in her case, with her two daughters and also her boyfriend.
That's right. Her collaborator in writing.
Who
that was the love of her life, but she was always quite a, you know, loved men. She was really interested in men.
She liked men, but in those days, this was in the early 1940s by now, and in those days, it's hard to imagine right now, it was scandalous to be, in a relationship that didn't involve marriage and living together.
Exactly.
It was you walked into this house and you say, hey, what is this guy doing here? Did you ask that, or were you?
Well, I knew that he was her boyfriend, but you know, and I was well brought up. I didn't like ask Mary and Nancy E. But you know, they were respectable, but because he had a place, he had a room somewhere else as well, but it was in effect. He was her live-in boyfriend, but he was the love of her life.
He had a different address, but he was the respectable way to do things.
And look, this is what I was trying to say. Societies had different ideas. The Bohemians of that era were just as free, and they invented, you know, freedom. No wonder some of the churches in the eastern part of the state thought this was an immoral place.
which they do to this day.
They do?
Yeah, they do. Well, give us, before you knew she was going to be famous, and she's just the mother of your two of your good friends. Yeah. Was she just an ordinary mother?
She was never an ordinary mother. My parents were very much, we had a nuclear family and we had these values, but they weren't Puritan values and they weren't, horrible. I mean, we never discussed Betty Smith in our house, that they're immoral. My father was an immigrant. He was also an immigrant from a peasant class, and they are very strict there. But he was very affected by John Dewey, by his education in the United States, by the values of the United States. He was in the Army in the First World War as a corporal. But he was one of these enthusiasts about America without being tacky about it, you know, as in my big fat Greek wedding. The same enthusiasm for America pervaded in my father, but he was a maverick type of person. That's what I was trying to say. He was an individual immigrant than which you can't categorize other than individual. He was a show-off. He read a lot of stuff. He preached to us about John Dewey. He brought us up with kindergarten Plato at the table when we were kids, little kids.
Talking about your father now, and we're just going to leave Betty Smith behind.
We can never leave Betty Smith behind.
There's much more about who Betty Smith was really when you got to see her through Daphne Athis's eyes before she became famous. I just leave that. And I want to talk about your parents, both of them, for just a minute, in terms of growing up in the shack in Chapel Hill, but one which you all took pride in. Which of your parents nudged you towards your own aspirations to write?
Probably both. I mean, it was, we were brought up with fairy tales, Grimm's, with Greek myths from Daddy, with logic as a very, with Aesop's fables, you know, crows that couldn't get their beaks in, so would die because they did, the water was right there, but they were too dumb. Like that. It was, and then my mother was an avid reader. I mean, she was a Dickens on her.
So you were reading behind her. I mean, and you, the books were there.
Exactly.
You were picking them up and you loved them. Now, I'd love to talk some more about that. We've got to take a break.
Okay.
When we come back, just so you can be prepared, I want to ask you two things. I hope we can get to them both. But I want to ask you about Wayne.
Right.
And I want to ask you about teaching and tips for writers.
You want to ask me about Wayne?
Wayne and tips for writers, and that's what we'll do after
and
this.
And what, the writer?
You taught writing at Chapel Hill for more than 30
years. Oh, tips about writing.
What are some good ideas that will help those of us who would aspire to be better writers, maybe not great writers, better writers? What would you tell us? So,
those are
the questions. After the break. Daphne Athis and I'll be right back.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Daphne Athis, and I'm just having the best time. We're talking about and around her book, Chapel Hill in Plain Sight. It's a brand-new book. As I've told you, Daphne Athis, I think it should be required reading for people like me who are newcomers to Chapel Hill if they really want to get a view about what was going on. One of the things that fascinated me about your book was your deep friendship with Wayne all the way through high school and then all the way through college and then onward. And then you talk a little bit about his family later on. But I was left – I mean, clearly he was your first – he was the love of your life in some respects. Tell us about him and about your relationship with Wayne. Who was he?
Well, he was my first boyfriend because he came up to me in the high school hallway and said, "You're interesting." And I was
that you were 15 or 16 years old. Well, that was good.
He was about the same age.
And he's from Carrboro. He's from Milton.
Yes, and his mother went to the 8th grade and his father to the 4th grade. I mean, it was a...
But he was smart as heck, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And he was avid to read. He read everything. So, I mean, I invited him to the house. He became kind of a member of our household. He'd come and eat at night, and then he'd walk the railroad tracks to his house. But he, in his house, his father built a little house, and Wayne just moved in there and made it his. And that's where he lived, and he went in the house for meals. But, you know, half of those houses in Carbo didn't have bathrooms, and his father could do anything, went to the 4th grade, but he worked in the mill, and he was a plumber, and he actually put the pipes in for the shack of our house.
Uh-huh.
That was one of the deals he made. You know, that was good to get extra money, but because the mill was...
Well, let me just ask you this.
Yeah.
This developed, I mean, beautiful throughout your book. Wayne always pops up. And y'all are always doing things together, and having a good time, and a very respect. You know, the best kind of relationship in the sense that you were friends, but there was more to it than friendship.
Yeah, we were. we saved each other in, you might say, we saved each other as adolescents because he was very brilliant and he loved reading, and he rented one of his house from Horace Williams, who owned half the houses in Cabo.
Another time we want to talk about your
okay.
about Horace Williams. No. I want to talk about Horace Williams.
We saved each other because we didn't fit. I didn't fit because I didn't know anything about the South. He was my guide to the South. He was very objective. He didn't complain about being of the deprived class or the low-down class.
Were you all in love? Were you in love with each other?
We didn't know what love was in the, you know, to me, love was Heathcliff. But there were other people around. You know, we had, it was a little bit different. We were experimenters at love. We were compatriots at understanding the world. This is an incredible bond that very, very few people have.
Yeah,
I had it. You never get rid of it. It is unbelievably, it forms the way you look at the world. And if you look at the world, you have families. Everybody has a family. Every kid has a family. Every kid has a family, and they define themselves in relation to that for one thing, and then the high school herd for another. But what is the reality? That's sure. What Wayne and I analyzed.
Well, now you mentioned that Wayne had passed away recently.
Yes.
It's like losing still, even 50, 60 years later, like losing a family member.
Yes. Yes.
Well, all I can say is that if you read Daphne Apthis's Chapel Hill in Plain Sight, you'll come to admire Wayne and the relationship that you guys had.
It was very.
But as this conversation, you've left me wanting to know more.
I didn't answer your question.
No, but you didn't want to. So I want to ask you about, which is fine. I want to. People tell me you're one of the best teachers for writers. And I think of the best teachers of writing as being coaches of particular individuals and learning the particular strengths of individual writers and helping them learn themselves rather than hammering home things. But surely you have, for those of us who are never going to be great writers but would like to be better writers, what are some of the common things that you tell your students that seem to be helpful to them?
Well, I love, I think maybe they should read their stuff out loud.
Great. Always read it out loud to see how it really sounds to you.
I think it's very good to do that because then they can hear their repetitions and they can hear what they didn't do or what they ought to have done often. But I'm an eclectic person, and I'm eclectic, and I have seen 1,000 fads of writing because I have lived many decades. And I grew up in the time where there was no creative writing venue, certainly in high school, we had Phillips Russell. I had Phillips Russell. He had about 3 tips in all. It was wonderful, and he never gave an A. He said, if Shakespeare would have gotten an A, why would you?
Now, were his tips good?
Yes, they were good. They were because they were freewheeling. He said, bring on the bear, meaning make it, you know, get it in the medias res, where something's going to happen and you don't have to give all this hoo-ha.
Just get into the action.
It's at in medias res. Okay. But he said there were 3 types of writing, man against God, man against himself, and man against others, people. That's very wide ranging. But that seemed to make sense. The other thing, I do have a tip though. Besides, read out loud what you wrote. Read. It's kind of Betty Smithish, but more even more so. I say read big stuff. Read everything. Read everything. Read everything. But read classical stuff. Read 19th century stuff. Read whatever you like. Don't read it if it bores you. But everything bores everybody now because everything is quick. It's totally different. We had radio and we had reading. We did not have TV. So
it's harder to be a it's harder to make reading enjoyable now because of the we've been spoiled by the
I think that this is there are different values now. The value now is fast and funny. That doesn't mean it's bad. It means it's a reality. It's fast and funny. But everybody knows, you know, and I love internet and I love operating on email because you can be fast and funny.
Daphne Ath is approaching the Twitter generation and then the internet. And it's, but in the meantime, thanks for your great book, Chapel Hill in Plain Sight, and for coming and sharing a little bit of that book with us here on Who's Talking.
Thank you for inviting me.
And thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking, and we'll be right back here soon.